Yesterday I began a talk that I want to begin the same way today with a quotation from the Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster. I'm talking on a subject that is rarely addressed in a seminary, or for that matter, in a church. It's the subject of intimacy, spiritual intimacy. Paul writes in Philippians 3:10, that I may know him. The Amplified says, for my determined purpose is that I may know him. That is, that I may progressively become more deeply and intimately acquainted with him, perceiving and recognizing the wonders of his person, and on it goes. We're talking about being intimate with God, something that cannot be taught. There is no course, Intimacy 101. There is no such thing. These things are caught, and they become a part of our person if the disciplines are in place, which is the outworking of my words today. Superficiality is the curse of our age, writes Foster. The doctrine of instant satisfaction is a primary spiritual problem. The desperate need today is not for a greater number of intelligent people or gifted people, but for deep people. I want that in my life more than any other thing on this earth. And I think I speak for most of us. But it will not receive the kind of applause and public honor that usually comes to those who operate in the flesh and achieve great accomplishments. Though every once in a while, a window of hope is opened and I breathe deeply with gratitude. It happened this past summer, the summer of 95. The sports world was brought to its feet as a man broke a record that had been set by the legendary Lou Gehrig of the New York Yankees. Cal Ripken Jr., the shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles, when he walked onto the playing field to begin his 2,131st game, the crowd stood to its feet and exploded in applause and cheers for 22 uninterrupted minutes. Why? Well, when you stop to think, it was not because of some incredible physical feat. Ripken hadn't been faster than any other player. He hadn't necessarily been more accurate or stronger than any other ball player or athlete. He had simply been faithful, consistent, consistently there to play the game 2,131 games. And the record goes on and on as he played even more games that followed. Sometimes I am haunted by the words from Hebrews 12. Look in your Bibles as I have mine open. And we have pictured for us a great cloud of witnesses cheering us on, if you will. These witnesses are surrounding us. I believe they are the saints gone on beyond us. Christ, the first and foremost of all who have gone on before us, is there beyond the finish line, wishing us the best, helping us along the way. But here is this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, and the writer commands us to lay aside every encumbrance, and then even the thing that so easily besets us. Some teach that means each one of us has a besetting sin, and we must address it more than any other in our pilgrimage from earth to heaven. I think in light of the context, it's the sin of unbelief. Having had a full chapter describing God's great hall of faith, he comes with the therefore in chapter 12 and verse 1. Since we have a cloud of witnesses, some of whom have been named here in the 11th chapter, let us join the company and step up to the plate, if you will, and play the game faithfully, consistently, with integrity and accountability and humility and grace. And on the virtues go. Let us run. Notice he says it here in verse 1 and again in verse 2 and again in verse 3. With endurance. The race that we set? No, we don't set the race. I would have never in my lifetime or a dozen lifetimes have guessed the race that God had set before me personally. Nor will you when you are my age, 61. In case some of you, knock it off. Just the young man with the old hair, as a friend of mine calls me. How do you do that? How do you run this kind of race? Verse 2 tells us. We fix our eyes on Jesus. It's almost a cliche, unfortunately. The King James says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. This is a good rendering. Fixing. Looking to. Focused on Jesus. That is what gives a seminary education meaning. That is what builds character that backs up the knowledge and readies us for ministry here, abroad, wherever, before the public, in private, at home, wherever. I think it was that sort of thing that led Paul to say his determined purpose was to know Christ deeply and intimately. Now we're kind of working our way through a short list of the disciplines involved in such a relationship with the Savior. Because I don't think we can enter into such a fixation, if you will, quickly or easily or automatically. I think those who desire such a relationship allow me the word, struggle more than most. They struggle. They have deep undercurrents of tension pulling us between the real world around us that's lost its way centuries ago and the spiritual realm within us. And so there is this constant pulling and pushing back and forth. So I am not suggesting, as I talk on these disciplines, that they will come easily or certainly that they will come naturally. They are supernatural things that by the grace of God, the Spirit of God, ignites in our lives and will not leave us alone as we're on the road toward cultivating them, perfecting them. I think it begins with reordering our lives, which is the discipline of simplicity. I talked about this enough yesterday. There's no reason to go back over it. I turned to 2 Corinthians 11:3 and pointed out how Paul's fear was that the readers there in Corinth, and as the Spirit planned it, all generations that have followed might be drawn from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. I fear that for you more than any other thing. I fear that more than the demonic warfare that'll go on around you and around this place. I fear that more than the pressures of your home, I fear most that you'll be drawn away from the purity and simplicity of devotion to Jesus Christ. That you'll become an expert in the text, but cold in your heart, indifferent to people, losing increasingly more so as you become more effective on your feet, losing compassion and a heart for people. I fear that for you. Simplicity will help. Secondly, we must learn to be still. While reordering our lives, we will discover soon the value of being still. Psalm 46, verse 10 gives the command, "Be still and know that I am God." I think the order of the words are as important as the terms themselves, is as important as the terms themselves. Being still enables us to discover God is God. I've learned nothing about God in a hurry. It was when I was set aside, either deliberately or enforced by illness or circumstances, that new vistas of an understanding of God broke on me. And I arose from the illness deeper, because stillness does that. One man writes, "Silence is an indispensable discipline in the spiritual life." Another writes, "Silence guards the fire within the soul." Our lives are starved for silence. To listen to silence. I was walking across the campus yesterday, and a student from the local dental college was sitting under our tree out here in the green space, and I met her. She gave me her name, and she said, I hope you don't mind, but she said, "I'm not a student," but she said, "There's something about the serenity of this campus that I don't have on my campus, and I just love being here." Just watching the squirrels play. Some of you haven't even noticed the squirrels. Squirrels? Squirrels are in the classroom, not out on the campus. They're here. They're proliferating. They're all over the place. And the flowers, so carefully kept. The grounds, if you will, manicured compared to so much around us in this old world. Take time. Listen to the wind whistle through the trees. Find a lake and walk along the shore without a pack of vocabulary cards. Just walk. And as we will point out in a moment, alone, not a pack of people with you. Stillness, silence. There are sounds there. I don't know how it works, and I don't know why it works. I just know that it does work when in silence God communicates fresh things to me. Solomon writes in Proverbs 4 and verse 23, turn there if you will, a word of command, and there's mystery in it. "Watch over your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life." If I were in a counseling ministry, I would take that as one of my favorite verses of Scripture. Within the heart are the vistas of life, are the secrets of life. The heart is like a vault holding the treasures of life. And the busyness of our times keeps all of that hidden, tucked down, pushed away. Today's term, denied In silence, it erupts. Sometimes it vomits itself out all over us. So he says, guard your heart. There are some very, very precious things the Lord's given you that are not to be told, not to be shared, not to be made into a devotional, not to be added to a sermon. They're nobody's business. They're to be guarded, treasured. My dad used to say, keep more behind the counter than you ever put on display, son. Wise counsel. That means there has to be depth. There have to be hidden shelves within my being that are never opened to the public. Maybe occasionally to my wife or to my children, as happened this morning. I got up early and the dawn was perhaps 30, 40 minutes away. And I sat down to write each one of my children. They range in age from 25 to 34. And on my birthday, it seemed appropriate that I thank God for theirs. And I wrote Kurt a letter, our oldest, and in it, I opened just a bit of my heart, and I recorded it for him to read. It wouldn't mean much to anyone else here, but it meant the world to me to give it, and it will mean the world to my son, our oldest, to receive it, for it's priceless. And then I wrote Carissa, our 32-year-old daughter, mother of two busy children. I told her what a darling she has been in my life and in our life. Then I wrote Colleen, and another busy mother of two, 28-year-old daughter, and then our 25-year-old son, Chuck. For a few moments, I didn't guard my heart. I opened it. And it took stillness for that to transpire. Take time. Take time. If it means another year of seminary, take time. You won't even remember the extra year 30 years from now. Listen to a somewhat lengthy reading of Henri Nouwen. Recently, I was driving through Los Angeles, and suddenly I had the strange sensation of driving through a huge dictionary. Wherever I looked, there were words trying to take my eyes from the road. They said, use me, take me, buy me, drink me, smell me, touch me, kiss me, sleep with me. In such a world, who can maintain respect for words? All this to suggest that words, my own included, have lost their creative power. Their limitless multiplication has made us lose confidence in words and cause us to think, more often than not, they're just words. Do I exaggerate? Let us focus for a moment on theological education. What else is the goal of theological education than to bring us closer to the Lord our God so that we may be more faithful to the great commandment to love Him with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and our neighbor as ourselves? Seminaries and divinity schools must lead theology students into an ever-growing communion with God, with each other, and with their fellow human beings. Theological education is meant to form our whole persons toward an increasing conformity with the mind of Christ. He's got it. That intimacy with Christ, that's why you are here. That's what you take with you that is invaluable, that you caught in your years in these classrooms and chapel services, tested like you have seldom been tested or will ever be tested again. Thirdly, we must cultivate serenity, the discipline of solitude. Now, I'm a people person, usually. There are times I get weary of the crowd. I get tired of the chatter. One of my favorite Tozer quotes is, "May not the inadequacy of much of our spiritual experience be traced back to our habit of skipping through the corridor of the kingdom like children in the marketplace, always chattering about everything, but pausing to learn the true value of nothing." Chatter, 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 talk, 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 words, 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 people, people, people. And I'll tell you, it'll burn you out in ministry. You must find ways to be alone. How often I have been encouraged with the words of Mark chapter 6, where Jesus, in the midst of a very involved, life-changing ministry for the disciples, hears them in a report, Mark 6, verse 30, as the apostles gathered together with Jesus, they reported to him all that they had done and taught. How pleased they must have been, how challenged, how many questions they must have had. They were on the firing line, in the trenches, doing ministry, and they came back to sort of regroup, get the answers, and go back at it. Whoa! Christ says, wait a minute, stop. Come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while. That must have shocked some of those 12. Observe by yourselves, lonely place, rest. For there were many people coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. I've been there, done that. I'll tell you, there is an incredible impact that makes on an individual who speaks for God and who wants to walk with God. It's draining. It siphons the life. It takes the power from your words. This constant contact with people, people, people. Jesus saw it, saw the draining. Said, you men need some time away, some time to rest. That's why I say to people on pastoral staffs, take your day off. The old adage, I'd rather burn out than rust out. That's a stupid option. Both ways, you're out. Since when is burning out better than rusting out? Why should we have to be out? Rest. Take it easy. I remember coming into those offices there in the Fullerton Free Church and seeing a light on before I got there. And the light on after I left, and cornering that dear brother, love him dearly, one of the finest men I've ever known, but a workaholic, and telling him if he didn't take his day off and if he didn't shorten his days, he would no longer be on this staff. That had a way of getting his attention. He wrote me recently and he said, I have you to thank for a whole new dimension of ministry I would have never discovered on my own. Not me. Not my insight, it's the Lord himself. They went away in the boat to a lonely place by themselves. What do you do when you're alone? What do you do in the solitude? Well, I have found the value of journaling, and I brought a copy of one of my journals with me. This is a journal that was given me, interestingly, by our team of interns. Over the 15 years of pastoral internship at the Fullerton Church, they've all signed it. Most of them have signed it. It begins Friday, July 1, 1994. I'm beginning this journal on July 1, 94, the day I officially became president of Dallas Theological Seminary. Only by your grace, O God, have I been chosen and called to fill this position. Whatever is accomplished will be by your power. Therefore, only for your glory, guide me, O thou great Jehovah. And I sign it. Begins the journal. It's a journal full of memory. There's the inauguration. Still makes my stomach churn when I look at that inauguration. Here's a picture of Howie Hendricks and me. Look at that. Huh? We took that picture on July 14, Thursday. It is a journal, handwritten. You write it by hand. Some of you have been so connected to a computer, you've forgotten penmanship. You write it day after day, or if you wish, week after week. Don't become enslaved to this thing. This is a tool. This makes stillness meaningful. And this isn't a diary. This isn't a day timer. We have enough of those. And I keep one of those too. This is a journey. Think of journal and journey. This is a journey with God. This is what God is giving you. This book is full of prayers, full of frustrations, problems, concerns, visits in various places. There's one in Phoenix. Here's one I wrote just this morning on my birthday. Very personal things. It's just part of how you discover what's in your heart and what the Lord is giving you. And it's not to be published. My children have never read, nor has Cynthia, from my journal. This is between God and me. What a helpful discipline. And I don't write every day in it. It would be an enslavement if I had to do that. But the stillness with God opens my heart to messages from Him, not voices, but deep in my being from time in His Word and struggles I've had in understanding what He's saying. It begins to open up and I see it. Like Peter and John when they looked in the tomb and it clicked. It clicked. I see it. They were still. They were silent. If it's too mystical for you, that's your problem. We could all learn a lesson from the Desert Fathers, who knew dimensions of God most of us will never tap. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments, unfathomable His ways. And it's all there for us. The disciplines of intimacy are simplicity, silence, solitude. And you would anticipate this last one. Surrender. Surrender. You cannot walk proud before the Lord and cultivate these disciplines. You're humbled. You learn to say rather quickly, I don't know. I'm waiting on Him. I know this isn't Madison Avenue Slick. This is counsel from a friend who's been there and tried the other. I don't want it anymore. This builds security into an insecure life. This helps you find out who you are so you can be that under the control of the Spirit. This quiets things like envy, strife, belligerence, argumentativeness, stubbornness. It molds you. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. All your heart. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. With all your heart, in all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. The secret is the overused word, trust. little book, I'm on my second copy, by V. Raymond Edmond, called The Disciplines of Life. He includes this comment I use in closing. In every life, there is a pause that is better than onward rush, better than hewing or mightiest doing. 'Tis the standing still at sovereign will. There's a hush that is better than ardent speech, better than sighing or wilderness crying. 'Tis the being still at sovereign will. The pause and the hush sing a double song, in unison low and for all time long. O human soul, God's working plan goes on, nor needs the aid of man. Stand still and see, be still, and know. Let's just sit quietly before him for a moment or two. My Jesus.